Romans 3, beginning of verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means. For then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie, God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying? Their condemnation is just. Mikey, over to you.
Well, may I add my welcome to Chris. It's really good to see you all here this Thursday lunchtime. If you've not met before, my name is Mikey Williams. Well, we all hate injustice, don't we? It's inbuilt into us from really the earliest of ages. Think back to school days, and the one thing that was worse than getting into trouble yourself was when someone else was also involved and they got away with it. Injustice. Or, I mean, just think of everything going on, all the calls for Boris to resign currently, or the guy who was even leading that investigation into the number 10 Christmas party last year, and it turned out that he'd run his own party. Well, of course, he couldn't remain in that job, could he? Dishing out punishment to others when he'd been proved in the wrong himself. What right does he have to judge others? Injustice is something that we all feel strongly about, and especially when it is something that really matters to us personally. Well, our passage today raises a question that really matters to all of us. It is God just? Is God fair in the way that he deals with us, in particular, in the way that he judges us, in the way that he either saves or punishes people after we die? Of course, that is obviously a question that really matters. I mean, just think of the implications if God were to be unjust. What if God's judgment was just totally random? Some just happen to be his favorites, whereas others maybe catch him in a bad mood and get unlucky. We'd never know where we stood. If there was no consistency, we'd have no reason to respect God, and actually no reason at all to trust him. We might as well just give up being a Christian. Well, we're diving back into Romans here, this book of the Bible. And to catch us up where we left off, it's as though Paul, the writer, has been laying out some sort of cosmic courtroom drama. It's not the people versus O.J. Simpson. It's more like the people versus God. Or more accurately, it's actually God bringing the case against the people of the whole world, past and present. God versus humanity. And the case so far has spelled out humanity's unrighteousness. How we've all suppressed the truth about God, failed to live to the standards that we know are right, and so we all face God's judgment. Chapter 2 made clear, though, that this includes even the Jewish people. Even though they prided themselves as being God's people, the Jews, too, were in the dock, as well as non-Jews. And so what Paul's been doing is he's been playing out these hypothetical protests to these indictments, but showing how none of them hold up. So the Jews protested, hang on, you can't judge us. We have God's law. The prosecution replied, but you haven't properly kept the law. They say, but we're circumcised. We have the mark of God's special people. The prosecution replied, external markers are pointless when you're not acting like God's people on the inside. Well, as we start chapter 3 here, our passage today, Paul pictures the Jews putting forward really a final defense. But it's got pretty desperate. They've really now given up trying to say that they are in the right. And instead here, they turn to accuse God of doing wrong. They're essentially saying, if we're going down, well, hang on, God should be in the dock as well. We'll see that their protests are actually baseless, and it all gets increasingly petulant. A bit like when a sports person knows that they're heading for a heavy defeat, and so they turn on the referee. They say, they've got it wrong, it's not fair. That is essentially their accusation, you'll see on the handout there. Isn't it unfair of God to judge even the Jews along with everyone else? Isn't that unjust of God? Well, I've broken down for us the ensuing cross-examination from our verses, and here is the first point at stake, also on your sheet. Does it show God to be unfaithful? Verse 1, then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? They're saying, well, what was the point in being Jewish, having circumcision and so on, if it's not going to save us? Isn't that unfair, God? You said that we were your special people. Was that all just a lie? Well, the reply is in verse 2. What advantage has the Jew? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God, the words of God. The answer is that the Jews were special. They had every privilege and supremely the oracles of God, God's gracious covenant promises to them. The problem only came when, verse 3, they were unfaithful. The Jews didn't hold to the covenant. Despite maintaining some external markers, most just gave up really trusting God's promises in a way that truly changed them. A bit like if someone's being given membership to one of the city's private dining clubs, and one day they turn up, they're looking the part, they're in the required blazer and so on, but then they decide it's a good idea to start a mass food fight, and trifle ends up all over the old paintings and all the rest of it. Well, of course, they would have their membership revoked, wouldn't they? They would have forfeited the privileges that had been available to them. And so too, the Jews had forfeited the privilege and blessings that had been available to them. But that's on them. That is not on God. God judging the Jews doesn't show him to be unfaithful. It shows that they were unfaithful. Verse 3 then asks, well, does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? I think the point of this question is that if God does judge the Jewish people, then is he just giving up on the promises that he had made to bless them? Well, by no means. Paul will go on to show in future chapters that God does keep his promise, but to the true people of God, those who are Jews inwardly, that is anyone who comes to God by faith, not works. Although, wonderfully, that does include some ethnic Jews too. So no, nothing can nullify God's faithfulness. To the challenge, does judging the Jews show God to be unfaithful? It is a resounding no. And actually, it is the very opposite. Judging the Jews, in fact, shows God to be in the right, righteous. Have another look, if you would, from verse 3. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar. See, for God to be true to his word, he actually needs to judge the Jews, because that was always the stated consequence if they were unfaithful to their covenant, which they were. So God can't just let them off, otherwise he would be a liar, unfaithful, like them. But no, God is always faithful, and so judging them is the right thing to do. What would be wrong were to be if God were just to sweep their sin under the carpet, as though sin didn't matter that much. I mean, wouldn't we all hate that if that happened in Ghislaine Maxwell's case? What is unjust is when people get away with wickedness just because they're maybe rich or important or special in some way. So judging the Jews shows God actually to be right, righteous. And to prove it, Paul turns now to the testimony of great King David. We can come back to picturing this as a courtroom drama, and the prosecution announces that they're calling a key witness, and everyone's eyes are on the door in suspense, and after a suitably dramatic pause, in he walks, and there is an audible gasp. You see the opposition visibly wilts, because this is the daddy of all witnesses, who commands the respect of just everyone in the room. No one will be able to refute his testimony. That is the effect of Paul using those words in verse 4, as it is written, and then quoting from David, from Psalm 51, as he says, that you, God, may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. Quoting anything from the Old Testament would have been chastening enough for the Jews, but David was their absolute hero, their greatest king. They couldn't dare refute him. And yet his testimony, those many years before, shatters their case. Because Psalm 51 is actually David acknowledging his own sin, facing the music after God had pronounced punishment on him, and actually admitting that God is right to do so, that God is justified, as it says there in his words of judgment. Well, if God is right to judge even King David, his most special figure in the Old Testament in many ways, then surely he is right to judge everyone for their failings, no matter who they are. So should God let off the Jews just because they're his special people? Well, David says no. There should be no exceptions, David says, not even me. God shows no preferential treatment, and that is what shows him actually to be righteous. Well, after that, it's a bit of a killer blow. The opposition case at this stage is in tatters, and yet for some reason, they seem to try and carry on in just utter desperation with these further protests. Although Paul flags them up for us as stereotypically human, not even really worthy to be entertained by God, these protests get increasingly ridiculous at this stage and are easily dismantled. A bit like a child who's been caught red-handed by his dad, and now he's been protesting, but now it just kind of escalates into a tantrum, and it just gets embarrassing for everyone as the child just wails, "It's not fair!" That's essentially what is going on here. Verse 5. They protest, "But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say, that God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us?" I speak in a human way. "By no means. For then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not actually do evil that good may come?" Well, back in our courtroom drama, it's the last-ditch protests of someone who everyone knows now is a criminal. He's been exposed. But he says, "Well, how is it fair that you look good for catching me? My wrongdoing makes you look good. You're praised for it. Doesn't that actually call into question your motive?" Well, the protest is shut down again. "By no means. God was in any way unrighteous, he wouldn't be judge of the world, but he is. God doesn't judge people to try and boost his own cred as if he needed that. He doesn't do it to get a kick out of it. God judges to uphold justice, to do what is right and true. So yes, the way that he judges you does abound to his glory, but that doesn't mean he owes you anything. I mean, verse 8 is as though our criminal in this drama is protesting, "Shouldn't you actually let me off so that I can go and commit more evil crimes so that you've got a chance to look even better from catching me again?" Well, of course, such twisted thinking is just dismissed as ridiculous. It only further shows that God's case is the truth and that their impending judgment is actually deserved. Their condemnation, as it says, is just. And that brings us really to our conclusion, that God is a just judge. The result of this hypothetical court case is to prove beyond all doubt that God is right to judge everybody. People won't like it, of course. Still today, there will be all sorts of protests, not too dissimilar from what we see in our passage, maybe non-Jewish equivalents, but there's simply no counter-argument that sticks against this indictment against humanity. I mean, every conceivable line of objection or questioning against God just falls away against God's impeccable character, because he has been seen to be just absolutely fair and consistent, faithful to his word and good, absolutely true, and he always will be. God's character is just utterly flawless, and it means that we are the ones in the wrong. Certainly puts the outspoken atheists in their place, whether it's Dawkins trying to pick sort of intellectual holes, or the likes of Ricky Gervais just trying to mock God. Well, you may remember a few years back the interview with Stephen Fry, where he was asked what he would say to God if it turned out he was wrong and God did really exist. And he said, "I'd say to God, how dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It is utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world that is so full of injustice and pain?" Well, I shudder to think, when Stephen Fry does in fact meet God, what God will say to him. Yes, of course, there are things that are difficult to understand in this world, but to call God mean and wrong and evil and unjust, well, those words, "how dare you," will surely come back to him. God is the very opposite of all of those things. God cares more about justice and doing what is right than anyone else. That is why he is judge of the world and not us. Stephen Fry has got it fatally wrong because he assumes that humanity are in the right. Did you notice he said, "It's not our fault"? And so he accuses God of being the one in the wrong. He tries to put God in the dock. But of course, the reality is that we are the guilty ones in the dock. And God is always in the right. No accusation against God has any basis whatsoever. And it's crucial to remember this if we are Christians here today. It's crucial for when we have questions of our own. It means that we can trust God with those questions. We can trust that he's good and knows what he's doing, even if we can't see how. Just recently, a friend shared with me that their brother, who is severely disabled mentally and physically, needs an operation, but his disability means that there's a pretty high chance, much higher than normal, that he won't wake up from the general anesthetic. And my friend said, if he dies, I'm unsure of his salvation and where he'll go. Well, obviously, that is such a difficult question, isn't it? Such a difficult situation. But my friend rightly concluded, it's in God's hands. We were able to speak of how we can trust that God always does what is right. He is a just judge. We can trust him in those sorts of situations. And there is all sorts of other comfort that we can take from knowing that God deals rightly with every single person. I mean, think of those who have done terrible things and have seemed to get away with it, the likes of Jeffrey Epstein, Jimmy Savile, and so on. Well, God will make sure that no one gets away with evil. God will bring justice one day. He will right every wrong. Isn't that a good thing? He is a just judge. And as we close, all this is meant to strengthen us spiritually. That is Paul's big aim in Romans, that we would be strengthened to be increasingly unashamed of God and of his gospel, which is the only thing that saves us from this judgment that we deserve. How we must seek to share this gospel with our colleagues and with all those around us. Everyone needs to know that they are rightly facing God's judgment. and that no excuse that they might try to think of or put forward, no excuse can save them. Only Jesus can. But wouldn't it be great if we could actually explain to people how judgment shows that God is a good God, a God who is fair and just, the God actually that we all want to be running the world. And then people will see that he really is a God that we can trust to save us.